We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on WILL. My name is Alicia Kirchhoff and I'm the Associate Director for the Russian, East European and Eurasian Center at the University of Illinois, and today I'm sitting in for David Inge. Our guest today is filmmaker Robin Hessman, director of the film My Perestroika. This film has received a great deal of praise. It was a 2010 selection for the Sundance Film Festival and winner of the Special Jury Award from Silver Docs Documentary Festival. Ms. Hessman will be in Champaign-Urbana on Monday, September 19th at 4 p.m. in room 66 of the library for a screening of this film on the University of Illinois campus, and later again that evening at 7 p.m. at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign. Both screenings are open to the public and will be followed by a question and answer session with the filmmaker. Robin, welcome to Focus.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you, that's for sure. The Soviet Union during the mid-1980s was a period of change and reforms within the Communist Party known as Perestroika. Perestroika was Mikhail Gorbachev's program of economic, political, and social restructuring, and many argue that it became the unintended catalyst for dismantling a system of Soviet governance that had taken nearly three-quarters of a century to erect. In the Soviet Union itself, reactions to the new policies were mixed. Reform policies rocked the foundation of traditional power bases in the party, economy, and society, but it did not replace them entirely. Newfound freedoms of assembly, speech, religion, the right to strike, and multi-candidate elections undermined not only the Soviet Union's established authoritarian structures at the time, but also the familiar sense of order and predictability. Long-suppressed economic, ethnic and social grievances led to clashes, strikes, and growing crime rates. By July of 1990, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was regarded by liberals and nationalists of the constituent republics as unable to lead the country. And many of the Soviet republics began to split into large pro-sovereignty and pro-union factions and further weakened party control. And by 1991, the Soviet Union had collapsed. The film My Perestroika follows five ordinary Russians living in these extraordinary times, from their sheltered Soviet childhood to the collapse of the Soviet Union during their teenage years to the constantly shifting political landscape of post-Soviet Russia. Together, these childhood classmates paint a complex picture of the dreams and disillusionment of those raised behind the Iron Curtain. So, Robin, if you could, please start off today by telling our listeners a little bit about the film, namely the subjects whose personal stories are captured by the film.
Sure. One preface is that in Soviet schools, people are with the same classmates, really from the first day of first grade until they graduate from high school. So it is an enormous shared experience, a very significant formative years. And the subjects of my film were all childhood classmates. There are Borda and Luba, who are a married couple. They both teach history in a grade school in Moscow. Their son, Mark, a very precocious little kid, also goes there. And they have a perspective on the country not only as people who grew up there, but as history teachers who also are trying to make sense of their country's past for their students today, who are all kids who grew up after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and for whom it's really, like ancient Rome and has no bearing on their lives today. Then there's Andre. He is a businessman. He has a chain of expensive French men's dress shirt stores. So this chain, Cafe Cotton, is growing all over Russia. When I began filming, he had three stores, and by the time I finished, he had 17. Then on the sort of opposite extreme is Ruslan. Ruslan was in a big punk Russian band in the late 80s, early 90s. It was one of the first big punk bands that toured in Europe, and he was with them for 12 years before he quit the band. And now he gives banjo lessons. He's taught himself the banjo. He busks in the subway, and he's just joined a new bluegrass band. Then there's Olga, and Olga is a single mother, And she works in a billiard table company. So her job is to drive all over Moscow, servicing these companies, these pubs and casinos that rent and buy the billiard tables. And so the five of them, still for the most part, well, all of them except for Andre, live around the corner from each other, all in the apartments that they grew up in, and they share their very different perspectives on their childhood and on the changes that happened as they were teenagers, and have fairly different lives today.
Well, thank you for that extensive summary of the film. For those of us just joining us, this is Focus on WILL. And if you have a question for Robin Hessman, filmmaker for the film My Perestroika, please give us a call at 333-9455 or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455, or you can always email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. So getting back to this idea that the Soviet Union, and learning about the Soviet Union for some of the students in Borya and Luba's courses, it's like ancient Rome, is what you had mentioned. So
yes.
Do you find the same sort of experience? You have several screenings on college campuses of this film where a large portion of your audience not only do not remember this time in history, the 1980s, but they weren't even born yet. Do you experience that same sort of conceptual disconnect, I guess? I'm not quite sure what one would call it, but...
It's been very interesting, and often when I show the film on college campuses, I do turn the table and ask questions of the students myself because I'm so fascinated. You know, I was a child in the Cold War. It was very much my formative years as, you know, a 6, 7, 8-year-old that there's this evil empire out there that supposedly has a sole goal to destroy the planet with nuclear weapons and certainly, you know, crush America if possible. And so it's fascinating for me to see these, you know, young adults who I ask all the time, what did they know of Russia? What is their perspective of Russia? It's now just another country out there in Europe for them. And I have to say that I haven't gotten a very good idea of how much they know. Some people have talked about films of the Cold War being very romantic. I just was at Sarah Lawrence last week, and one of the professors says that there is this growing romanticism because of movies of the Cold War, and that's why more people are taking Russian today. But it isn't clear how much they really understand of what that time was even like here. One thing I found is when the film was in its larger theatrical release, a lot of parents and children would come together, both Americans and Russian-Americans. And for the American parents, they're showing their children a very equivalent picture of what life is like. A lot of Americans have commented that they had no idea how similar things were in the Soviet Union as they were to here, and find the film illuminating in that respect. But for Russian-Americans, whose kids grew up here and never had any experience there, they find it very valuable to show their particular childhood. So it is the film is very interesting across generational lines, which I've found really fascinating to hear the conversations that happen afterwards.
Interesting. So I guess that leads me to another question about your audiences. And you had talked about Russian-Americans and non-Russian-American Americans. And it makes me wonder a bit about the response internationally that your film has received, not just among Russian audiences, but maybe those who live now in countries that were once part of the Soviet Union that are now independent states. I'm thinking specifically of Latvia or Lithuania. I believe that you had a screening in some of the Baltic states at some point. And wondering what your response internationally has been.
Well, unfortunately, I have not personally been able to attend yet any of the screenings in the former Soviet republics. But on our Facebook group, we have a very active My Perestroika Facebook page. People from Latvia were commenting, and from Lithuania. It's showing in Latvia this week. It showed in Lithuania earlier this year. And it will be showing in Georgia also in September and in Kiev. But when I've shown it in other countries in Sweden or Norway or in the Netherlands and Rotterdam, there have been people who currently live in Estonia, currently live in the Baltics, who have come up to me afterwards and said what they think. And one young man said to me, who's from Estonia, said to me that he had grown up always hating Russians, and we just unequivocally. And he said that the film was the first thing he had seen that made him, of course, realize the humanity of, you know, people, and that the film is very much about people. It's not a political story. It's about what happens to individuals when you're at a certain point in your life on these sweeping waves of historical and political change. And that experience was, for the most part, common of everybody across the Soviet Union. And so I have heard it was his then mission to get it shown in all of the Baltics, because he thought it was a valuable experience for people who grew up, you know, after the collapse with one idea of hating all Russians. So that, you know, that was certainly welcome to hear. The film is really beyond the politics. It's about individuals.
Well, that is quite fascinating, actually, to hear that a member of your audience took this as a learning moment. And so then that makes me wonder if your documentary really is about people, as I would agree it is, absolutely. There are a number of documentaries in existence about the Soviet Union, about Gorbachev or the fall of communism, and topics that are all related to these issues. And one thing that is different about your approach to this film relative to the others is there's an absence of kind of the thunderous overarching narration over historic footage, let's say, and there's an absence of expert testimony on the topic that is interjected in between the scenes of people in their lived experience. And I was wondering then, so was this by design? And if so, what if you could talk a little bit about your objectives for making this film in the first place relative to this question.
It was absolutely by design. First of all, I felt that there had been some very good films out there that took a kind of larger analytical view of the, you know, geopolitical fallout of some of the economic, sociological factors. And what I was really interested was the story of people. I also don't believe that there is one historical truth that can sum up this very complicated experience. And I think the film was really born out of being asked. I lived in Russia, I should say, from 1991 to 1999. Part of that was undergraduate years. I went to graduate school at the film school in Moscow. I had my degree in film directing from GEIC, which is the All-Russian State Institute of Cinematography. And then for 4.5 years after that, I produced the Russian Sesame Street, Ulitsa Sezam. So that was, I guess, the ages of 18 to 27 for me, and an enormous part of my formative years. And when I returned to the States, I found myself often asked, you know, these large sweeping questions such as, so, what do Russians think of life there today? Or, so, how have they adjusted to the transition? And for every story or anecdote that I could tell from which, you know, my friend could wring a conclusion of this is the takeaway and this is what to think about Russia today, there were just as many stories that would give a contradictory conclusion. And the experience of this enormous transition is not black and white. It's very multifaceted and full of contradictions, even within an individual. And you can see the people in the film struggling as they try. Olga, for example, once begins talking about how it was better then in that, and then she contradicts herself, well, it wasn't better, it was just simpler. And there is no one easy answer. So it was very much a goal for me to hopefully to find people whose stories would show some of these ambiguities and complications of living through that time.
Well, this is certainly a fascinating conversation. We're speaking today with Robin Hessman, filmmaker of the film My Perestroika. For those of you just joining us, this is Focus on WILL. If you have any questions, you can send us an email at WILL-talk@illinois.edu, or you can call us at 333-9455 or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Robin Hessman is with us today and discussing her film, My Perestroika. She will be on campus at the University of Illinois on Monday, September 19th at 4 p.m., where we will have a screening at the main library in room 66, followed by a discussion with Robin Hessman herself. And later that evening, there will also be another screening at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign. So getting back to our discussion here, you've mentioned a few times the whole idea of nostalgia. And this year, 2011, marks the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Soviet Union. And in the early years of the 1990s, there was arguably a certain spirit of hope associated with the political and social changes that were taking place, both, I guess I would argue, within Russia and also around the world. Among certain circles, at least. But in your experience, has that sense of hope for the future, particularly among the generation who you feature in your film, dwindled at all? Those who came of age during Perestroika and the fall of the Soviet Union certainly had kind of the promise of a new generation as they were looking forward to this new country and the changes taking place. Would you say now that there is a strong sense of nostalgia for this period among those who lived it, or as you were saying before, it kind of depends on who you ask, and what is the root of that nostalgia, if it does exist, or what is romanticized about that period of time?
I don't think that many people spend a lot of time now thinking back to the early 90s and those sort of heady days of euphoria and hope. Actually, I think that the five subjects of my film commented that the conversations we had really provided them with an excuse to think back and reflect over the last 20 years. But honestly, in the busy pace of everyday life, there isn't much opportunity or I suppose even desire to from the majority of the people that I've spoken to. I do agree that for the large part, really rather overwhelmingly, for those people that were full of hope standing in front of the Russian White House in August of 91, almost exactly 20 years ago, when the coup failed, the coup that tried to halt all of the reforms, when the coup failed, people felt a real sense that now there was no turning back, that now, at least the people of this generation, felt that now Russia would, you know, become a normal country functioning as many Western European countries did. And there was just an idea that there was a kind of bright, shining future ahead. And, of course, the whole process of democracy and of market economy was a lot bumpier and more complicated than anyone predicted. And I honestly think about that a lot, you know, this year, seeing the events in Tahrir Square and as Arab Spring has been unfolding, that, you know, after the euphoria in the square and the joy of success and freedom fades, there's a lot of very difficult work that's left to do. So over these years, it is true that the hope has slowly dwindled away, as it took longer for reforms to take place, as there was rampant corruption, and certainly today things aren't what people would have hoped for. So for the most part, Borden Luba commented on this a little bit in the film. On the one hand, also, life takes over. People have children, they have jobs, they don't have time to stand in the street anymore. But also in the climate today in Russia, it really isn't that easy. You know, freedom of assembly is curtailed. Protests and demonstrations are not granted any permits. It's just considered putting oneself out unnecessarily and possibly dangerously. And there are, you know, people have chosen for the most part to focus on their personal lives, which to a large extent is reminiscent of what was happening during the 70s and 80s. There was a very separate public and private sphere. The public, you tried for the most part not to pay attention to what was happening up on top. You really couldn't affect it. You made the choices you needed to make for your job or didn't. And people found the meaning in their life usually through their friends and their family and literature and music and concentrated elsewhere. And that really changed under Gorbachev when for the first time the public and private really did merge and people felt a reason to be engaged and an empowerment that there was a purpose to have their voice be heard. And I would say from the people I've spoken to, a lot of people point to 1993 when Yeltsin fired on the parliament as really the end of that era of perhaps from 87, 88 to 93 as the moment when there was a lot of possibility. And from then, it really has been, unfortunately, shrinking and shrinking.
Well, you raise a number of interesting points, for sure, about both about kind of the lived experience, I guess, and just also how, and you touched on this earlier, how similar life is. And that here, certainly in the United States, we're all focused on our jobs and responsibilities and our private life, and we're not always thinking back on our own lived experience of the 1980s or 90s. So it's an interesting parallel to make, that's for sure. And so that then, I guess, leads me to another thought about kind of your inspiration for the film, and you've maybe touched on this a little bit throughout our discussion so far, but what led you to this particular group of people from this particular generation? Was there a personal motivation, or was it a situation where you had kind of a nebulous conception of how you wanted to pursue a film project, and this is an opportunity that unfolded, or what led you to Boria and Luba?
Well, I wanted to make a film about this transition generation, which is more or less my generation of Russians, the generation that I joined when I went there for the first time at 18. So because they had a really unique experience of a completely Soviet childhood with no indication that anything would ever change, and then they were teenagers and just coming of age at that point in their own lives when you begin to question things and figure out who you are in a different way, just at the moment when Gorbachev came and all of a sudden the very foundation of their country is questioned and shaken, and there are new archives opening up, new things being allowed to say that had been forbidden before. And then they graduated from college just when the Soviet Union collapsed. So they were no longer assigned a job as soon as they graduated, as had been the case for so many decades, and they all had to figure out how to invent themselves and become adults in this new society. So I was first focused on the generation of people that I wanted to tell the stories in the film. And from the very beginning, I wanted to focus on childhood classmates because it is such a strong connection between people spending all of your school years with the same 20 or 25 people. Provides a lot of opportunity for, well, perhaps contradictory memories, complementary memories. Even if people don't remain close and see each other on a daily basis after school, there certainly is a very strong bond. You know, I know people in Moscow today in their 70s who meet once a year with their classmates. So that the sort of the institution of the classmate is something that I thought would be important. So I began looking for people. I went on my first research trip back to Moscow. I sat in the archives. I started to gather 8mm home movie footage to find a very intimate personal portrayal of life back then. And along the way, I spoke to dozens and dozens of 30-somethings from all walks of life. And I figured that when I found the first person who absolutely had to be in the film, from there, I would find his or her classmates. And that's what happened. I found, I guess about a year into working on the film, I met Borda and Luba. And from the first evening I spent with them, over many, many hours of conversation, I felt, all right, this is where I begin. They have such a wonderful way of individually, of looking back at their own past and as individuals with certainly, you know, emotional and amusing ties. They had very different childhoods, I should say. They grew up across the street from each other, but Luba was from a very patriotic pro-Soviet family. She wholeheartedly believed in the system. She was a good pioneer, which is the youngest or the second youngest communist youth group, and then a perfect Komsomol member, which is the sort of older communist youth group. And for her, perestroika was an utter shock that all of a sudden everything she had been taught to believe wasn't the case. Borda, on the other hand, grew up in a sort of a family where they would listen to Voice of America with the bathtub faucets running so the neighbors couldn't hear. He talks about noticing by in the seventh or eighth grade the hypocrisy between the official lines and what is actually happening in front of him. So I really also loved their perspectives on their Soviet childhood and adolescence, because certainly, you know, in the West, we were given the impression that everybody in the Soviet Union believed the same thing. They all thought the same thing. It was this one big gray monolith, and that couldn't be further from the case. So once I met them, I asked about their childhood classmates, and Ruslan Stupin as the most famous from the big punk rock group Naive was the first I met, and then I met Olga, and then I met Andre. And I didn't want too many people in the film because one of my goals was for the audience to really feel like they got to know these people very, very well, rather than have a kind of broad, sweeping scope of the entire class where you can never keep track of who is who and that you don't really get to know them as people. I wanted to focus on a few people and get to know them much better.
Well, that is, I look forward to picking this thread back up after our break. This is WILL. You're listening to Focus. We're speaking with Robin Hessman, filmmaker, discussing her film My Perestroika, which we will be showing at the University of Illinois campus on Monday, September 19th at 4 p.m. at the library, and again at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign at 7 p.m. also on September 19th. So as I mentioned, we'll be taking a quick break, but we'll be back with more on Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
And we're back on Focus on WILL. My name is Alicia Kirchhoff. I'm in for David Inge today, and we are talking with Robin Hessman, filmmaker of My Perestroika. If you have any questions for our guest today, you can email us, WILL-talk@illinois.edu, or you can give us a call at 333-9455. Or if you're further out in our listening area, you can call us at 1-800-222-9455. So, Robin, before the break, we were talking a bit about your subjects for the film and how they were selected and how you identified them and identified the stories that you had wanted to tell about their lives. And you mentioned that in the film there is some footage from the 1970s and 1980s, and you had already begun to collect that before you met your subjects and who would ultimately be in the film. And I just wanted to ask you a bit about that. How did you go about the process of researching your film, and how did you find these historic documentaries and home movies and just the film clips that are woven into the story of My Perestroika?
Well, I knew I wanted to juxtapose, you know, the public images and the private images. And, you know, the public images made by various Soviet studios, I had a wonderful time finding an archive there. I spent weeks and weeks and weeks in several archives, the state television archives, the Krasnogorsk archives, where there are a lot of newsreels housed. And that was really fascinating and wonderful. The footage, you know, these were all filmed on 35 millimeter. There were newsreels for the Pioneer. There were individual films on subjects like, you know, the children of the 21st century. And so a film made in 1980 would talk about what Soviet children in the 21st century would be like. And I had a really wonderful time just searching for the film. You know, in the beginning, not knowing who the people in my film were going to be, it was more difficult to choose material because so much of the film is predicated on the five of them and their stories, and the footage, you know, follows their stories. But in the beginning, just to get a general overview, I spent quite a lot of time in those archives. The home movies were a much larger challenge because it wasn't that common to have an 8mm camera back then. It was still considered pretty expensive, and it was a very specific hobby. It's not like people would send off their film to Kodak to get processed. People were processing them in their bathrooms and printing and developing their bathrooms. And so it was a very specific milieu, and not that many people had them. So for that, it was, you know, really word of mouth. I put an ad in a few newspapers. There were some well-known bloggers who publicized that, you know, an American filmmaker is looking for home movies from the 70s or 80s. I found some material here from Russian-Americans who had immigrated to the States through friends of friends. It was a lot of just asking anybody I knew, as who I met when I was in Moscow, if they knew anybody who ever had an 8mm camera back then. And so the film started to trickle in. sometimes, you know, it was almost like a scene out of a spy movie. I would meet someone on a train platform who had passed film through the train conductor that was coming from, you know, Yekaterinburg or somewhere in Siberia, and I'd be handed a little paper bag filled with real film. And so I assumed, because these films are relatively rare, that the images I would have from them would be of people who were the same age, that this would be the cohort of the subjects of the film. But I never for a moment imagined that I would actually have footage of the people who would be in my film. And that happened as an incredible gift, that the first night I was at Borda Nuba's house and was talking to them about the film, I asked them, as I asked anybody, did they know anyone who had ever taken 8mm home movies? And Borda really started laughing, and he said that his father was completely obsessed with them. It was his main hobby, and he followed him throughout his childhood, and they just had stacks and stacks of film. And he opened the closet, and there was indeed this enormous stack of reels of film, and actually even 16mm film. His father had a friend who worked at one of the film studios, and so sometimes he would film on 16. And we sat there that very night, and we took out the projector and set up the screen, and with Mark, their son, who was about eight at the time, who had never seen any of these films, we spent the next few hours watching them. And what was also so special is that Borda's father didn't only film his son. He went into the school very often. And so I have all of the subjects of the film as children, thanks to Borda's father.
Well, having the home movies certainly adds a lot of texture to the story of the film, and it's wonderful how they are juxtaposed within kind of the retelling of that period of time by the subjects as they live now in their context now. And we actually have two callers right now. We'll start with caller number one from Lovington. What's your question?
I'm going to ask my question and hang up and listen.
Okay.
It sounds like a good movie. Do you say it's showing up at Champaign?
It is. It will be at the University of Illinois on Monday at 4 p.m. at the library, and again at 7 p.m. in downtown Champaign at the Art Theater. The library showing is free, and at the Art Theater there is a fee for admission.
Do you have any plans or hopes of distributing it more widely?
Yes, the film has aired on PBS in June, and it will be eventually out on DVD, available for the public. Right now, the DVD is only available for university use, for educational and institutional use. But at some point next year, there will be a DVD for the public.
My question was really not about the film so much as what is your sense of how it seems to me like the whole thing. Pretty radically changed governments, really, well, with practically no violence at all. Was it because of the economic situation of the common people, or that was my main question. I'll hang up. Listen, thanks.
So was the question about when the government originally transferred you in the 90s, that there was no violence along with that transition?
Yes, I believe that's what our caller is asking, is that this was a relatively bloodless revolution, and the question is about why that may have been the case.
Well, that's a wonderful question. I made a film back in 1992, and I was a student, about a 13-year-old boy, and I remember him saying that he was sure there was going to be a civil war by the following year. I think that a lot of people thought that there might be more violence that erupted. But I think when the coup failed and the hardliners realized that they were not able to stop the progress of reform, that was a watershed moment. Of course, there was some violence in the republics. That's the one complaint that a lot of former Soviet citizens have against Gorbachev, that while he was, as they say, traipsing around with Margaret Thatcher and Reagan, that he was ignoring some very significant developments that were happening at home. And there was bloodshed in Georgia, and there was bloodshed in the Baltics as these countries were going through their sort of separatist movements.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, a lot of the discussion, certainly, I guess, from a historic standpoint or even the media presented kind of a Moscow-centric story and not didn't necessarily highlight some of the conflict that existed in the outlying areas, which was very real and in some cases very violent. And in at least one situation didn't actually erupt until a few years later, until after 1993 or 92-93. So the reasons for that, though, I guess it's really anyone's guess. There are people still scratching their heads, I think, about why that was the case. And
and certainly in Armenia and Azerbaijan, there has been quite a lot of bloodshed in that ethnic conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh.
It's been more of a protracted, I guess, situation as opposed to a big, bloody, violent revolution in an immediate sense. But thank you for that question. And we do have one more from a caller on line two, Philo. Illinois, you are on the air.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember the Cold War. I was around back then, and I was a teenager. And I'm really rather amazed now that when you talk to a college student or even a graduate student at the U of I or anywhere else, they don't seem to know anything about it. And I was just wondering whether or not the people that you filmed and the former Soviets kind of remember that period of time.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a very similar situation there as it is here. That there is a generational fault line, and of course everybody who is old enough to remember it, you know, remembers it very, very well. And then, as far as the younger children go, it really depends on families for the most part. In the Soviet school system, they don't actually teach 20th century Soviet history until ninth grade. And in a very cursory manner, and then really in 11th grade, the final year of high school, do they delve into kind of 20th century history of their country, and also, and in that is configured, you know, history of the relation, the Cold War, and the relationship with the United States. But often the year ends, and they've only gotten as far as, say, Brezhnev or the Soviet. I mean, it is astonishing for me to see that there are many, many kids today in Russia who graduate from high school never even having studied in school, you know, what happened to the Soviet Union and how did it end. And one thing that the film touches on is this idea of the rewriting of history and the reinterpretation of history. You know, two of the people in the film are history teachers, and they were taught one version of the history of their country when they were children, and they were in school studying to become history teachers just as all of this change was happening. Actually, in 1988, the Soviet Union canceled history exams for the entire country because the archives were opening up and the old view of certain events was questioned. Nobody knew what the right answer would be on an exam that year. So to make things simpler, they just canceled them all. And, you know, today, Borden Lubo teaching Soviet history to this new generation. But one thing I hadn't anticipated when starting the film, it's there. Certainly in the early 90s, there were new books written that often were given prizes for being very critical and clear-eyed about some of the problematic pages of Soviet history that had never, ever been officially discussed before. But over these last 20 years, that also has been changing, and some of those books are taken out of the school and not awarded a stamp of approval by the Ministry of Education anymore, and there are new books so giving a new take on history once again. The cycle is continuing. I mean, certainly there are reevaluations of the past in every country. If we were to look at a textbook from the 60s or 70s, there would certainly, in the States, there would certainly be things in it that would raise our eyebrows as well in terms of attitudes and interpretations. But there it is. I think, you know, they have a very rich tradition of rewriting the past. Stalin would have portraits commissioned with himself next to Lenin to make himself look like he was Lenin's heir apparent, even though, as was later revealed, Lenin wrote a letter saying that he didn't want Stalin to be in charge of anything. And during the purges, people would be simply erased from photographs once they had been sent to the camp, so as if they never existed. So in a sense, this, you know, continual rewriting that really has happened to a large degree under Putin is just a continuation of past traditions.
Well, a big thanks to both of our callers for adding to our discussion today with filmmaker Robin Hessman. Her film, My Perestroika, is what is the topic of our discussion today on Focus. And there will be a screening of her film on Monday, September 19th on the University of Illinois campus at 4 p.m. in the main library. And again at 7 p.m. at the Art Theater that same evening. If there's anyone else in our listening area who has any questions for our filmmaker, you can reach us by email at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Or you can give us a call at the studio. The number here is 333-9455. Or if you are further out in our listening area, you can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. So in one of your responses earlier on, Robin, you had mentioned that some of your films came from some of the home movies that are used in the film, or that you had collected while you were in the process of making the film, had come from some far-off places in Russia, such as Ekaterinburg or other cities further out. Did it cross your mind at any point, or was it perhaps part of your plan to look at other major metropolitan areas outside of Moscow? Did you approach this as a project where you had wanted specifically to make the film about a group of classmates in Moscow, or were you exploring any city that was part of the Soviet Union as a potential place to identify your subjects and make your film?
Well, I certainly am fascinated with the experiences really in all of the former republics and in, you know, urban areas as well as rural areas. And at times, I just, you know, wish if it had been a dissertation, I would have had the freedom and luxury to, you know, to travel more extensively and to really focus on all of the different areas in the former Soviet Union. Moscow, they often say that Moscow is to Russia as New York is to the United States. And it really, Moscow is a different place. I think 87% of all of the money for the entire country of Russia, which is huge, is in Moscow. It's the capital of finance and politics. It's really like all of our regional capitals in one city. And things happen faster there. And the change is more visible immediately. And that was one part of the appeal. But another reason I focused on Moscow was honestly practical. I am an independent, nonprofit filmmaker. It took 5.5 years to make this film. I had to raise a lot of money for all of the costs and production. And Moscow was where I had lived for 7 years of my life. It's where I had a network of friends and colleagues. It's where I had people who could introduce me to people who could help me find home movies or provide a free place to stay in the early days of research or loan me some lighting equipment that I didn't have the budget for. So part of it was also practical.
So I guess in keeping with this discussion of making the film and that process, financial considerations and things aside, what were some of the difficulties that you encountered while filming in Moscow, or perhaps some that are specific to making a film in Russia? Were there any sort of, shall we say, bureaucratic constraints you may have encountered? Were there any special permissions? What was that experience for you as a filmmaker? Were you met with some resistance? Were people unwilling to speak with you at all about this time in their past?
Well, in that sense, I have to say I was I had very little difficulty. I speak fluent Russian. I had lived there for many years. I'm a graduate of the film school there. I didn't, since for the most part I was filming private individuals in their homes and their places of work, all I needed was permission from them or from their, you know, place of employment to film. And I didn't need to get any larger permission. I didn't film, you know, any, you know, larger public events. To that point, I had very little or no bureaucratic intervention. The director of School 57 was wonderful and allowed me free rein in the school. The parents of the children were wonderful. So I have to say I had a fairly easy time of it, but that's because of the nature of the film, that it's a very personal film and it's focused on these few private individuals, and people were very open with me. And I think also, and people have commented on that, that even Russian Americans have commented that they're not used to seeing Russians be so frank in front of a camera. And I think that's partly because I lived there for so long. I've shared a lot of the experiences that they did. So I wasn't an outsider. I wasn't a foreign journalist, you know, parachuting into Russia for 2 weeks with a microphone and a translator and asking them to tell me about that crazy perestroika thing that they lived through. You know, I had lived through it myself and lived through it for years. So I think that made a big difference. And I also filmed them over years and developed a relationship with each of them. That was different. And so they were all very open and welcoming in talking to me and being on camera.
Well, certainly that sense of comfort with you and that kind of personal intimacy comes through in the film. For those of you just joining us, this is Focus on WILL. We're speaking with filmmaker Robin Hessman today about her film My Perestroika. And if you have any questions for our filmmaker, you can give us a call at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. So getting back to some of the themes here that we've been discussing today, I know that there is an interest in our community to come out and see the film when you're here next week. And I have a question about what your film brings to an audience of people who maybe know very little about Russia or maybe have not really thought about it, those who are shall we say, a non-specialist or someone who's just interested in the film. What about your film can inform that sort of an audience, or what can that person take away from your film?
Well, that was one thing I worked very hard on, was to make the film accessible both to people who had grown up in Russia, for whom this was their past, and to people who had no background whatsoever. And that was a very delicate balancing act. But I think one of the strongest takeaways for people who don't have a past will be twofold. We'll be both seeing the footage, especially the whole movie footage, which really, in a sense, granted for many people an unprecedented intimate window into kind of immediacy of life as it was lived behind the Iron Curtain. These are images that we never saw in the States. You know, I certainly, as a kid, the only thing I remember seeing were tanks on Red Square or people in bread lines. And the human personal stuff of everyday life were just really unavailable to us. So I think that'll be one eye-opening part for people about the film. And the other is really just getting to know these five individuals who live in Moscow today. It's also a window onto their lives in contemporary Moscow. And people who have seen the film who had no particular background or interest in Russia have said that they feel like they've gotten to know each of them very, very well. And so I think just in terms of people who are curious about the world and interested in learning something they didn't, that the film will provide that window onto an experience.
So your film, you refer to this as a window onto something of a specific experience, and that leads me to wonder then, just as your subjects here are something of a thumbnail sketch of the lived experience during Perestroika, do you think that in 10 or, say, 20 years, there could be a similar story told about the lived experience of school children growing up, say, in the era of Putin? And are those relationships as school children still held as tightly today as they were in the Soviet era? Could one go back 20 years from now to people who are school children now and have a discussion of this nature, do you think? Or is this something that is specific to this particular period in time?
From what I've seen from my contemporaries' children in Moscow, it is similar, and that there is that kind of connection with classmates. One thing that I do wonder about, you know, here's an example of how things might or might not change. In the school that Borya Nuba teach at, there are a lot of international trips. And the ninth grade, for example, studies ancient Greece, and every year the ninth grade goes to Greece. But they don't buy the tickets until they've raised enough money for the entire class to go, and that's a combination of some government grants and also parents paying for their children. But if a parent can pay for more than their child, they do, happily. They'll pay for two or three kids to go. If someone can pay for only half of their child's expenses, then they'll pay that, or pay nothing if they can't. And nobody questions that, and everybody is happy to contribute because, of course, the entire class should go. It would be unheard of if somebody from the class had to miss out. And I do think about that and know that, you know, the generation of their parents are the generation of the people in the film, and for them, they grew up in a society where, you know, there's even a line when the pioneers salute that their hands have to be above their heads, so the interests of the collective is greater than the individual. And, you know, I do wonder in 20 years if the parents would say, well, you know, I'm sorry, it's just not my responsibility. You know, if Masha's parents can't pay, I'll pay for my own child to go. I don't know. That's something that I'm curious to see. I certainly was very surprised to see that that's how they're paying for all of the school trips now.
Oh, certainly. That seems like something of a hybrid from the old way, so to speak, of doing things to what one might consider now. So in that same vein of questioning, I'm wondering then, how do you think the relationships among the classmates that you feature in your film might evolve over the coming decade? Is this something that where their lives are very different now than they were when they were all classmates? And that's something that the film highlights, that here you have, they're all, by and large, everyday citizens of Moscow, but they're all in very different places and have different financial situations. And I'm wondering, will those things that divide them become greater than the shared experience earlier on in their lives in the years to come?
Well, I have to say, for this, you know, strong connection and past between them, they don't all see each other, you know, continuously on a regular basis. Borda and Ruslan do get together from time to time, but the rest of them, you know, they'll run into each other in the post office and be very glad to see each other. But they aren't a very large part of each other's lives. And that is often simply because of the pace of life now. One of the things that is so different from the way that things were when they were growing up is that there really was a lot more time, and there was it's a lot more difficult for people to, you know, to get by. I look at each of their schedules and each of their work life. Luba alone teaches nonstop, often from 8 in the morning until 6:30 at night with 10-minute breaks in between. You know, after that, she'll go home and grade papers and prepare exams and cook and clean, and they teach on Saturday as well. And there just really isn't that much time for them to be very integrated in each other's lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that my prediction is that things will pretty much remain as they are today in terms of the five of them and the similarities and differences. I don't anticipate anything that to lead a larger rift. I mean, of all of them, Andre probably has the least time to socialize. He's a businessman with anybody, and you know, he's constantly working very, very late. And so he'll show up at a reunion and be very happy to be there, mm-hmm. but he just doesn't really have time for many relationships outside of his family and his work these days.
Robin, I'm on that subject of time, we're actually out of it, unfortunately. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today on Focus. Again, we've had a discussion today with Robin Hessman, filmmaker of My Perestroika. And her film, and in fact the filmmaker herself, will be in Champaign-Urbana on Monday, September 19th. For a screening at the main library in room 66 on the University of Illinois campus. And that will be followed by a question and answer session with Ms. Hessman. And later on that evening, there will be a second screening at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign, also followed by a discussion with the director. So thank you for listening, Robin. Again, thank you for your time. It's been great chatting with you. And this has been Focus on WILL.
Heather's Live. Mm-hmm. And I think that my prediction is that things will pretty much remain as they are today in terms of the five of them and the similarities and differences. I don't anticipate anything that to lead a larger rift. I mean, of all of them, Andre probably has the least time to socialize. He's a businessman with anybody, and you know, he's constantly working very, very late. And so he'll show up at a reunion and be very happy to be there. Mm-hmm. But he just doesn't really have time for many relationships mm-hmm. outside of his family and his work these days.
Robin, I'm on that subject of time, we're actually out of it, unfortunately. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today on Focus. Again, we've had a discussion today with Robin Hessman, filmmaker of My Perestroika. And her film, and in fact the filmmaker herself, will be in Champaign-Urbana on Monday, September 19th. For a screening at the main library in room 66 on the University of Illinois campus. And that will be followed by a question and answer session with Ms. Hessman. And later on that evening, there will be a second screening at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign, also followed with a discussion by a discussion with the director. So thank you for listening. Robin, again, thank you for your time. It's been great chatting with you. And this has been Focus on WILL.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com.